Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, anthropologist Claudio Lomnitz discusses his memoir, Nuestra America, My Family in the Vertigo of Translation. With Princeton University professor Arcadio Diaz-Quinonez, this conversation took place March 9th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Tonight's program is the latest in the Jean and John Rowe series, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today, held in conjunction with the exhibit of the same name that can be seen at my-america.org. From Germany to Peru to California, historian and anthropologist Claudio Lomnitz turns a scholar's eye to the story of his own family's history. Nuestra America traces the intersections of Latin American and Jewish culture through World War II, the Holocaust in exile, leftist politics, and early Zionism. His linguist study of the way in which parents and children tell stories about the past to inform the present makes for a narrative that poet Arcadio Diaz-Quinonez called brilliant and beautifully written. Claudio and Arcadio join us now for a conversation about the book.
Well, thank you all for joining us tonight, and thank you, Arcadio, so much for doing this this conversation.
Oh, thank you. It's really a pleasure. I'm so happy to be able to celebrate you and your wonderful book on Nuestra America, and to share some thoughts about it here with tonight and with the audience. It's a book that I have admired in Spanish and even more now in English. It's a book written twice, as you say in the book, in Spanish first and then in English. History and family history, biography, but also autobiography. I think it's, for me, very important how a Jewish community took shape in exile, a story of exiles and diasporas. I think it's a very moving, learned book, because you have a superb eye for the human condition, to use the Hannah Arendt title, and an incredible talent for storytelling, the stories of women and men, showing both their strength, but also their vulnerability. I think that's what I find here in this book. I wanted to show the book, the beautiful cover of the book, and the photo too. So I think that indicates biography and autobiography. Childhood is an important topic, and the relationship of the child with the elders in the family. For me, you know, the most important question, or one of the most important questions here in this book, is what does it really mean to belong? What does it mean to belong? And actually, not one, but multiple belongings. Belonging to the family, belonging to a Latin American community, a national community. What does it mean to be at the same time a member of a Jewish community and Mexican? Mm-hmm. What does it mean when you cross borders, new borders? Mm-hmm. And the linguistic complexity of crossing borders. That's all in this very rich book. And then also I find that you're telling stories, but also making links where no one else has made links before. I think that's what the way I read the book, that you're telling stories and making important links, in this case, very prominently to Latin America, the case of your grandfather, and it's part intellectual history, a very important intellectual history. The relationship with Mariátegui in Peru, and a whole political movement and a political moment, and the repression of that movement at the same time too. the idea that diaspora is different, complex, that there are gains and losses too, that comes very prominently in the book, all the gains, but also the losses together. That's why I say the human condition, you know, that Hannah Arendt thought about displacement, violence. So I wanted to ask you maybe about this subtle exploration of belonging that I find in the book. Belonging to the family, belonging to the nation, belonging to a broader, larger community. If that for you has been an important important issue and topic in narrating this story. Maybe I can start with that question.
Thanks. I mean, yeah, that's a big question, because to some extent it's something that I discovered and was developing in the course of the writing of the book, and it's part of the transformative effect of writing, is in connection to belonging. In part, I think it's reflected in the title itself, because Nuestra America, at first at some point I started thinking that had to be the title of this book.
Tell us more about that title. Yes,
and the title came in that image, and I just was unable to shake it. I tried other titles, mm-hmm. and that's the title that just was grafted onto my mind. And in part, it's interesting because I think it has to do with your question of belonging, because. In part, I think that the initial image came to me in an intimist kind of way. Nuestra America, our America, like my family's America, or a kind of marginal take on America, right? In a minor key, as opposed to, let's say, a Nuestra America in the major key of the Martí tradition or whatever, of thinking of Spanish America or Ibero-America as opposed to Anglo-America. This one was more modest. It was like more, well, my family's take. That's how it started. But I have to say that the more I thought about it and the more I worked with it, the more I thought that this belonging, this holding on to this America was, first of all, a necessary act,
yes,
and not so optional as I had imagined it when I, mm-hmm. For myself, when I was thinking about my grandparents, less optional, more a necessity, more a commitment, and it resonated in the end with this what I thought of as a kind of Zapatista approach. Yeah. To belonging, which is, which comes from the Flores Magón tradition, from yes. the anarchist tradition in Spain, but in Mexico, of the land belongs to those who work it.
Yeah.
And to at a certain point, I thought, well, the land belongs to those who work it, and the belonging is something that is connected to certain kind of work. And mm-hmm. that was, at the moment that became clearer to me, my story started seeming a little bit less marginal than I had imagined.
Mm.
And in some way, I now think that this story, which is a story in part of the destruction of Europe and
mm-hmm.
and what that meant for South America and
right.
for and what that meant for me. I now think that the destruction of Europe in the 20th century could be thought of almost as a fourth route for Latin American culture.
That's very interesting, yes.
So we have the traditional European, indigenous, and African roots of Latin
America. Because of the role of exiles and diaspora and new beginnings and new forms of belonging, because of that too, so important. In various countries, no?
I think so. I think it's true all over, and that there are some characteristics that this Jewish history, I think, is a big part of, but it's not exclusively a Jewish thing.
Right.
I don't think.
Mm.
It has to do in part, I think it has to do in part with a kind of universalism.
Yes.
That became a necessity in the face of the destruction of Europe, if you were an anti-fascist.
Right. Sorry, just to interrupt a little, I would like to hear from you more about your grandfather and Peru and Mariátegui, because that's also Nuestra América. I mean, he's a protagonist. Mm-hmm. He is an important character, one of the important characters in the narrative. Could you tell us more about him and the importance and how you were discovering and rediscovering? Because this is a book about discovery too. Discovery and rediscovering, right? That's interesting. And particularly with him and others, you were discovering that history.
Yes, it's true, because my grandfather died when I was 13, and I was very close to him. I loved him, and I always had him, present at some level. But at the same time, there's so much that I didn't know or didn't understand or rethought or discovered, as you say, in writing and in working on this book. He was born in 1905 in a town called Nova Sulitza, which was a little bit like a Macondo in my family. This Nova Sulitza was that probably is some testament to my grandfather's storytelling, because I don't have a similar image of a town for any other of my grandparents. But this Nova Sulitza was a little bit of a Macondo. It was a sort of originary town kind of a story. Mm. And it was a town that was a border. I discovered writing the book. I never understood this until I started working on this.
It's one of your many discoveries here, right?
Mm-hmm. One of my discoveries is that my grandfather came from a border town. And that the town that he was born on was literally crossed by the border between the Russian and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His family came from the Austro-Hungarian side, but settled on the Russian side. And so it's a border story from the start. And that kind of schism, fracture, and multiplicity of languages that comes along with that is, I think, part of the yeah. story, and part of what's relevant about this moment that you're talking about, his arrival to Peru in the 1920s, and his and my grandmother, they met in Lima, is friendship with Mariátegui, which became a mystery to me. Because Mariátegui, for those of you who don't know South America or South American history, was really a major Marxist thinker, and one of the great modern vanguardist thinkers of, I think, in general, and certainly
yes.
South America. Yes. And I had always inherited this as a kind of badge of honor that my grandparents were, you know, so close to Mariátegui and such close friends. But when I started reading the book, the friendship became more mysterious to me. Like, why? Mm. What was in it for him, for Mariátegui?
Right.
because Mariátegui was already a great, and although he was very young, he was already really a great personage. And my grandparents were starting; they were not as nowhere near, I think, consequence that Mariátegui already had in the 20s. And I think that part of the proximity, I discovered that part of the proximity did come exactly from this sort of universalism,
right?
Exactly from language, kind of a Goethe sort of idea of world literature, I think.
An openness to diversity and intellectual traditions and to the world, no? That's interesting at the same time, because he's a protagonist. I wanted to ask you too about some of the women who are in the book, because it's belonging seems to be different in some cases there too. Some of them are intellectuals, some of them are writers, some of them are noted in the book because they remain silent. about some of the chapters of the family history. Could you tell us a bit about that too, the women in your narrative?
Talk a second about my paternal grandmother, because that was also to me a big change that happened in me in the process of researching and writing the book. My father was born in Cologne. My father's family are German Jews, and they emigrated to Santiago, which was where I was born, in Chile, in 1938. And my grandmother was an opera singer, and with a frustrated career because of the exile, but not only because of the exile. Turned out that really Nazism and and the rise of the Nazis in Germany had a key part in terminating her career. But there's a whole story that was uncovered in this book, which is the assassination of her father, of my great-grandfather, my father's grandfather, which I had never heard about. That is, my father never told me the story. After my father's death, just a few years ago, he did leave a notebook of some memories in which he mentions that his grandfather was killed, but he was never told why or by whom. He was misled to think that the grandfather had been killed by a disgruntled employee. This man, his name was
Sina. It's a way of silencing the story, right?
And it's a silence of the story, because it was actually a hate crime. It was done by this Freikorps, that is the early, the very first months, actually, of the rise of the Nazi Party. My grandmother named her son, gave her son the same name as her father. Her son, my father, was born 2 or 3 years after this assassination, but in a Latinate way, so it was not as Jewish sounding. So Sina, C-I-N-N-A, Latin name.
Yes.
And hid this whole story. And as in some way, the question of protection, of intergenerational protection, and the role of some of the women in my family in intergenerational protection, which included, in her case, really hiding, sitting on a very fundamental truth, which is the murder of her father. Led me to look at her and to find out more about her than I had. I did know her pretty well. She died when I was in my early 20s, and to discover. In her case, she had cathected onto German sort of high culture, because she had been born in Poland. They had emigrated from Galicia to Mannheim in Germany when she was maybe 9 or 10. And she became a lover of German culture, and so of opera, of singing, but also of literature. And then the Nazis kill her father, her career as a singer is basically terminated, and then they emigrate to first to Belgium and then to Chile. So I think that this strong connection on her part to one high culture, which was German high culture, and then being sort of kicked out of that,
yes,
is something that I still don't totally. I still haven't totally calibrated how that affects me, how that affected my father, how that might affect me. There is, I think, some depth of.
So you're attempting to sort out that past in the book too. That makes it very powerful to make sense of the world of your parents and grandparents. And their traumas too. That doesn't stop. I mean, it goes on and on. And it's very, I mean, in that sense, it's a book that speaks, I think, very deeply to all of us in these dark times. so many refugees and so many displaced persons and the traumas and the losses and what are they going to retain for the children and grandchildren, what they choose to remain to hide or to remain silent about. That's it speaks very powerfully to our times too. I see that in the book. I feel that in the book, you know, the treatment of, that's why I was referring to gains and losses in this process. Some of them are very, very deep personal traumas and you're trying to make sense of the family as well, how well they were able to survive. That's how I read it too.
Yes.
And also, I wanted to ask you about also something related, because in your previous, or in one of your previous books, a book that I admire enormously, because it goes back to the national question on the Flores Magón, and the book, that book is also a book about crossing borders, and it's also a book about repression, and it's also a book about, I think, strength and vulnerability. No? It's an important chapter of the Mexican and American history too. And you are a historian and you are an anthropologist. My question is, what is the relation, how do you see the relationship between that previous book on Flores Magón and Nuestra America? Because I see many of the same issues there, no? Mm-hmm. The nation, borders, languages. Mm-hmm. And you are a Mexican scholar and intellectual, and you are also have been in the United States for a long time now. You are an American academic in many ways, and you are at least bilingual in English and Spanish, what you write. Mm-hmm. And all those topics are in your previous book as well. Mm-hmm. Who gets to write the story? And what is the role of the writer who can step in and can step out, or can go in, can go across the border linguistically and culturally? What does it say about you too? That's my question.
Well, I do think that it's astute of you to pick up this connection with that, with the return of Comrade Ricardo Flores Magón, with this book that I wrote about the Mexican anarchists and their American socialist friends.
It's really a wonderful book, American socialist and Mexican, radicals. It's a frontier book. It's a wonderful book.
It's a frontier book, and I think that it was the writing of that book is what made this book possible, because I had maybe 20 years ago thought of writing something about my family. I taped interviews with my mother and with my uncles, as a kind of anthropologist. I did a number of close interviews. I tried to. And then once I had all that, I didn't have a book. I mean, I didn't even start writing it. What I thought was, okay, well, maybe I don't have anything to say about this. At least I'll preserve this documents. But I couldn't really think about how to write them, how to write this. And I think that the Flores Magón book made it possible to a large degree, because that's a book about the Mexican Revolution. That takes an eccentric viewpoint with regard to the Mexican Revolution. The Mexican Revolution has always been told, at least in Mexico, as a national saga. And this book tells the Mexican Revolution as a transnational saga, as something that actually emerged to a very large degree outside of Mexico.
It's also a book that goes then against a narrow version of America as is used in this country, no?
Yes. Yeah. Because first of all, the Mexican Revolution is co-produced in a set of friendships between right. Americans and Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And it's and also in from the U.S. point of view, with interesting identifications with things to do with happening in Mexico. Like, for example, in the case of the Mexican Revolution, Americans concerned with slavery in Mexico, right. bondage, or the Trail of Tears, the genocide of the native peoples of the U.S., then being transposed onto Mexican politics and creating a new mentality that was neither American, U.S. American, or Mexican, but something right. new. And I think that this is once I saw that, I was able to write this book, because this book is neither Jewish history nor South American history, as if those right. two things were separate. What this book does is show, I think it does, in a very personal way, and not in an academic way, but still, what I think it does show is that South American cultural history and the Jewish history that I know and understand in some way made each other. And that was not something that I could visualize or envision before looking at this movement, this radical movement that happened on the border in the early 20th century.
A very transformative movement, and for the full of violence and tragedy and death and prison and mm-hmm. But also in that book, as in this one, you raise the question of the nationalist discourse and how nations appropriate, how even heroes become national after mm-hmm. After the state has institutionalized its views. That's very interesting and very important today, you know, I think.
And there's some kind of killing that happens in that national appropriation, in my view. Mm-hmm. There's yes. It's almost like a second killing.
Yes, right.
Because and you see it too in the way that I read, for example, Mariátegui, this yes. such important figure in Nuestra América, in this book. Well, I read Mariátegui in college, like many people do when they go to college and read social sciences or intellectual history of Latin America. And I had tended to read him in a somewhat, first of all, strongly in the Latin Americanist and also somewhat nationalist vein, which I think was completely mistaken. And it's a misreading of Mariátegui.
Right. That's, yeah, it's very illuminating in that sense, yes, mm-hmm. what you have done and yeah, you've been thinking. I wanted to ask you to pursue even further that question about belonging in your own, you're an academic in the United States, but you also are a Mexican, very active in Mexican intellectual life. You publish there, you have just been elected to El Colegio Nacional in Mexico. So you have managed to be in both places. You're a historian, anthropologist, you have written incredibly important books about Mexico and that we all treasure. So at the end of this book, A Sense of an Ending, in this beautiful book, Our America, the last chapter is devoted to you. No, it's in the first person singular, and you write, you tell the reader how you worked on this. It's about the childhood as a collective achievement, with beautiful pages too devoted to your reflection about yourself too. That's when the book becomes explicitly autobiographical as well. No, it's biographical and autobiographical, because these lives are linked. And I thought about Walter Benjamin, because Benjamin has a beautiful text that I always refer to, Excavation and Memory. And he writes that it's like a parable, and he says, excavation, memory is not an instrument, it's a medium. And when we start digging, we go back, even dig more in the soil that has been so nourishing us, no? And it seems to me that in a way, that's what you've been doing in this book too. You go back, you dig in into memories. But Benjamin suggests also that in the process of digging, one is transformed. The person, the man or the woman who is doing the digging is transformed. And I wanted to ask you about that.
It's a beautiful it's a beautiful image, and I think very true. To me, memory is, as you say, digging into memory. In this case, is also in dialogue with writing, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a movement between the creation in the writing, and the coming back and back and back into various memories.
Right.
And the process of going back in and out of them is, I think, to some extent, at least in my case, mediated by either questions to do with logic, almost things that I don't understand. Sometimes I don't understand them because I realize that I don't even understand the chronology, how this came before that. Did this come before that? So sometimes that digging, it takes almost an archaeological dimension, mm-hmm. because you're not sure what, if there's a temporal order that is confused in the memory. Right. And then some of it is happening in dialogue with really historical sources. That is not memory, that is primary documents that sit uneasily with the memories. Sometimes they sit uneasily because I don't have the memory,
right,
that corresponds to a fact, or sometimes the fact prompts a memory. But in that whole dialogue, and the construction of stories, I do feel that there's a way in which sort of the book wrote me. Not only I wrote,
right.
there is something like that happening. Even as you said, I mean, this book was written twice. I wrote it first in Spanish, and then I rewrote it in English. Mm. And even the rewriting in English, the second writing, was deeply transformative. This book is actually very, quite different in English than
very English. Different, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm not sure how exactly I would characterize the transformative side of it. I think one of it is to do with what you said earlier about recognizing, bringing these pasts into a present that, to some degree, needs them, needs that past, or can really use those experiences because of what you, I think, rightly called our dark times. Mm-hmm. So the story has a resonance with our contemporary situation. That is both intimate and general and, let's say, historical. That's one thing. But another, I think, is that you sit for a long time with these characters and these moments, and the books that they were reading, or the situations that they faced. And in that process, on the one hand, what matters, at least to me, became clearer. And on the other, I think that I became a little bit less harsh than I was, you know?
It had a slightly,
in terms of my own judgments with regard to my own family, some of those appreciations changed. And in that movement, which sometimes is subtle and sometimes large, in some cases it was smaller movement, in some cases it was bigger. But those movements, even when it's relatively small, they tended to make me all of a sudden more hesitant about the more settled judgments that I had.
Maybe the anthropologist in you too, there trying to self-examine. I wonder, because that's the writer and the anthropologist and the historian working at the same time and writing, you know, from that perspective. I was struck by the fact that Nuestra America is one word, nuestra, but in the plural, right? Our America. And then at the end, and you write in the third person most of the time, but you alternate with the first person. And at the end, it becomes so clearly the I, the first person singular. There's a movement in the book towards the I, first person singular, from the we in the title, which is the we of the family and the we of historical movements. And although there are many individual, very individual subjects there too, and persons who, portraits. It's a book about, you are offering portraits too. And that's one of the aspects I like about the book, the art of portraits, and you offer a lot. But then at the end, it's also a first person narrative, which is very moving and very touching. And I go back to the metaphor, digging and going back to the places you have been digging and digging and transformation. In that sense, it's a very rich book, and one can go back to it. And I was reading yesterday again that last part, because it's a way of going back to the book. You know, you start with the last chapter and see how it turns the book around too. It's interesting, in that sense. What was the reaction of the Spanish to the Spanish original, quote unquote, in places like Mexico?
Well, I think that it's interesting because on the one hand, as opposed to the US, the Jewish portion of the history is a lot less known there than here. And Jewish culture in the US is so, to some extent, so pervasive, so well known. And
in spite of Mexican writers like Margot Glantz and others, still very little known.
It's known in certain circles, but it's not as known. And I think that, but I have to say also that the South American part is not always so well known in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Contrary to what one might think, stories of Colombia or stories of Peru that are so present. So that's part of it. I think that to my mind, Mexico is ripe for rethinking its own national obsessions, That might not be well accepted. I mean, clearly we have right now a hyper-nationalist movement, president, a very nationalist, strongly nationalist movement as well. And it's not, and Mexico's always had a very strong reactive toward the US national identity. And I think is often quite rightly proud of a lot of that. But at the same time, Mexican integration to the U.S. is so deep right now, and it, not only to the U.S., but in the first place to the U.S., and then, you know, elsewhere toward the South as well, that to some extent the national narrative is something that is ringing a little bit hollow, and a book like this, which is at once intimate and socially connected, deeply connected to the social and political process, was I think something that really caught the attention of a number of people there, and not only in Mexico, also in South America. You know, so I think that it does have an unsettling effect that is at the same time productive for many people who are sitting on this problem, but from a different angle. Like, for example, the migratory angle with the United States, or you know, other kinds of transnational border connections.
Yeah, that leads me to another question, if I may. We have time, I think, for maybe one more question before we. I wanted to ask you about exit voice and loyalty. the question raised by Albert Hirschman's, we both admired him very much, and another great Jewish intellectual who came to the U.S. too and lived in Latin America. And he wrote a book, but also essays on that topic, exit voice and loyalty. What happens? And he's talking about displacement and exile and diaspora without using those words. What happens when a community leaves one place, goes to another? What happens to those left behind? Is voice stronger for those who left and weaker in those who remain behind? Or there's a relationship between voice and loyalty? And I think your book is dealing with those questions of voice and loyalty too, in exile. Mm-hmm. And what happens to those who were left behind, and what happens to those who start a new life too? What happens to their voice, and where is their loyalty? Those are big questions.
They're huge questions, and I think that very pertinent ones. I tend to think a little bit that that exile, that movement, strengthens voice a little bit, you know, in the sense that that the eccentricity makes it possible to think and say things that sometimes belonging, close belonging, inhibits because of some of the consequences of those thoughts. So there is something that, there is some freedom of thought that comes with some of the loss, some of the losses of exile, some of the losses in general, I think. But at the same time that there's that freedom, I think that there is also there is also the problem of loyalty, but and also both the loyalty and its opposite, right? Betrayal. The concern with betrayal, even betraying oneself and betraying those left behind, for instance, or those in the cases of, you know, major tragedies like the Holocaust and wars and the like, that those that survived versus those that did not, the problem of survival and how that is worked through, represented, and also silenced, is there. And I think that in this case, in my case, part of the condition of possibility of a book like this is not only questions of exile and movement, but also to some degree age. You know, I think that that at a certain, that I don't think this is a book I could have written 20 years ago or 30 years ago. The sense that that if you don't voice something, at a certain point, there's something that's irretrievably lost. I wrote this book, and this book was a very irresponsible book at a certain level. I mean, it's not a scholarly book in a traditional sense, because I don't have I don't have a number of the languages that I would have needed to write this as a historian would write this. I'm not a Jewish historian. I know, there's a lot of stuff that I have only tenuous a handle on. And at the same time, I thought, but if I don't write it, then no one will write it. There's no other, who else could write this? Nobody. So at a certain point, voice becomes, like a flight forward.
Claudio, Arcadio, thank you so much for that wonderful conversation.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, pop culture historian and best-selling author Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong discusses her new book, When Women Invented Television. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.